Welcome back to the program. Over the years, we've talked much about science and physics and the origins of the universe and the search for some kind of theory that explains it all. What we too often forget is that in science and physics, the search is informed by people, scientists with egos and emotions who sometimes make mistakes. Perhaps in better understanding the people of science, we can better understand what the search for order in the universe is all about. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Frank Close. He's a professor of physics at the University of Oxford. He's a longtime science writer, a past recipient of the Kelvin Medal from the Institute of Physics. He's the author of numerous books, including his latest, The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for an Orderly Universe. Frank Close, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Delight to have you here. This is a story that, while it is contemporary in so many ways, really begins about 50 years ago. Talk about that.
Yes, it was 50 years ago when a group of scientists had the ideas which, half a century later, have led to the exciting experiments of the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, huge particle accelerator in CERN. The ideas that they had, on the one hand, was to unify two of the forces of nature, the electromagnetic force, which is the one that holds atoms together and makes light and compass needles swing, and the weak force of radioactivity, which changes one element to another and makes the sun burn. And these two theories they brought together, and a Nobel Prize was given for that. It was shared by Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow. Nobel Prizes could only be given to a maximum of three, which meant that the fourth worker, John Ward, got left out, and that's one of the controversies of science that I deal with. But their theories weren't able to take account of the fact that the particles themselves have mass, which is a thing that got in the way of the simplest theoretical understanding. And that was the other part of the jigsaw puzzle. Another group of physicists, about half a dozen in total, of whom Peter Higgs is perhaps the most famous name, he of the Higgs boson, this group in 1964 independently came up with the way of getting mass into the theory without spoiling things like relativity and quantum mechanics and so forth. And when you put those two ideas together, unifying the theories on the one hand and incorporating mass by this trick on the other hand, a contemporary of mine, Gerhard Toft, in 1971 showed in his thesis that that enabled you to have a completely viable theoretical description of these forces of nature with which you could calculate numbers which have been tested over the years to accuracies of better than one part in a thousand. So we had great confidence that the basic ideas are right. However, the final link to prove the whole idea involves the prediction, which I think was unique to Peter Higgs out of all those, that there should be a further particle to complete the picture that we currently have, which is called the Higgs boson. And if one could produce that in an experiment and see how it decays, because it's a very short-lived beast, see how it decays, by studying the different ways that it decays from one experiment to another, you would eventually be able to show if indeed nature does it this way or whether it's just us being inventive. And that is what has led to the experiments of the Large Hadron Collider. And if and when the Higgs boson is finally confirmed, the whole question about Nobel Prizes for that part of the puzzle will surely come up, and this six is much larger than three, there's going to be some interesting questions.
Part of the reason why there was the search for this particle is that without it, the mathematics, as you talk about, don't necessarily add up. The numbers go askew, even though the theory makes sense on so many other levels.
Yes, I like the metaphor of they don't add up. In a sense, they add up far too much, in that one would end up with numbers like infinity, which are meaningless. They're beyond measure. And if you get infinity coming out of your calculations, it tells you haven't got a theory. It's as fundamental as that. And getting infinity out and getting finite numbers that fit with the experiment in, well, that was solved for the electromagnetic force in 1947 and won a Nobel Prize for Richard Feynman, among others. But an important part of that ability to make sense was that the carrier of the electromagnetic force, the photon, the quantum bundle of light, has no mass of its own. Now, in the case of the weak force of radioactivity, the problem there is that the analogous carrier of the force, a thing known as the W boson, which has been known experimentally for many years, that does have a mass. And that, if you like, simple difference, a massive W as against a massless photon, meant that you just couldn't play the trick, that the infinities persisted. And it was Higgs and collaborators' discovery that you could incorporate mass into the equations without disturbing other features that enabled us to get rid of the infinities there also. So we can get sense, theoretically, and that is what has been driving the attempt to finally show that this really is the real deal.
And, of course, this attempt to find out if it's the real deal has involved $10 billion in creating this Large Hadron Collider.
Yes, the Large Hadron Collider is the biggest experiment that has ever taken part in physics, and it's a completely worldwide venture. So, you know, although one uses the phrase $10 billion, it's not all the money from one country. In fact, it's a collaboration literally worldwide. All of Europe, North America, Australia, Asia, every particle physicist in the world in some way or another is directly or indirectly involved in this. And the numbers of people that have been involved, it's been 20 years to designing this machine and building it, and it's been working now for just over a year or so. Thousands of people, scientists, engineers, have been involved collaboratively. So that also raises another question, that when the Higgs boson is eventually found, who should really get the credits? Is it the particular individual that by chance happened to be working the day when the final signal came through, or some particular person who had the clever idea of looking in this place rather than that place, or the people who designed the machine and built it, or who? And it's really like an iceberg, that the people who one hears about are like the tip of the iceberg, but really beneath the waves, if you like, there's a huge army of people that have been involved over a long period of time collectively getting this whole thing to work.
Start at the top of the iceberg with Peter Higgs and the idea that he came up with that gave rise to the search for the Higgs boson.
The basic idea was that if you have a theory without any mass, everything works fine. How can you make mass appear, if you like, spontaneously? And this particular trick, I mean, to describe it over the air wouldn't help anybody. You have to go to a blackboard, which would get rid of our audience immediately. But it's familiar in many ways by analogy. When water freezes, for example, you get the beautiful structures of the snowflake, which have this nice six-fold symmetry. You rotate a snowflake through 60 degrees, and you get back to what you started. But if you rotate it through 5 degrees, you've got a rotated snowflake. You've got something different. Whereas when you melt the snowflake, and you've got a beautiful, smooth plate of water, you can rotate through any angle, and it looks the same. So the nature of the symmetry changes as you go from water to snowflake. And by analogy, the early universe, which was very, very hot, is like the water has got one level of symmetry in the equations. And the modern universe, which is very cold, is like the frozen snowflake. There are structures like you and me and planets and galaxies. So the nature of the frozen universe is different from the early universe, but actually the underlying laws are the same. They're just hidden from us at the moment. And it was incorporating that idea that led Higgs and Brout and Englert and Guralnik, Hagen and Kibble, to give them all their due, along with others like Phil Anderson and people like that, to realize that this was a way of making mass appear in your equations, and that was just a mathematical trick. Of those, it was only Higgs who drew attention to one further consequence of this mathematical game, and that is that there should be a new particle, which has become known as the Higgs boson, named after him. And the decay of that particle would be able to reveal whether nature really does do this mathematical trick or whether it's just a human creation.
Is finding this particle the only thing that will validate that theory? Or, in fact, if the particle isn't found, is the theory still potentially valid another way?
Well, that's a very deep question, which has been debated a huge amount in the last year or so. There are those who say that 40 years of successful calculation with the theory, which assumes that all of these ideas are correct. The fact that theory is so successful and can calculate numbers that agree with experiment to, you know, in some cases, one part in a trillion, which is remarkable. It's like the width of a human hair compared to the width of the Atlantic Ocean, for example. That can't be an accident. It's really telling you that behind the scenes, this whole thing is happening. But, you know, we always really need to be able to produce a thing and study it for real, rather than taking some mathematician's word for the fact that it all works, therefore it must be okay. And that is why the Higgs boson is important, to be able to see if indeed nature does do this. But it's more important than that, because the Higgs boson, this word that we keep throwing around, that was the idea that these people discussed 50 years ago. It just happens to be the simplest way that we can imagine nature doing this. But nature could be doing it in much more detailed, complicated ways. So the thing that we don't know is precisely how nature does this. The fact that something like this is happening, we are pretty certain of. But precisely how nature does it, we don't know. And if we can find the particle or whatever masquerades as the Higgs boson, if we can find it and study what it really looks like, then that will hopefully pose the questions for us. That will hopefully show us how to pose the questions that we really need the answers to. For example, the fact that this particle is responsible, say, for the mass of particles like the electron, very well, but why does the electron have the particular mass that it has? If it was different, we wouldn't be having this conversation. The fact that things exist seems to depend upon the particle masses just being right and the force of strength just being right. Why the universe is so convenient, we just don't know. And whether the discovery of the Higgs boson might reveal some unexpected quirk that would give us a clue how to chase the answer to that question, that's one of the excitements of science. If I knew the answer now, I'd be off to Stockholm immediately.
How close are we to finding the answer to this?
Well, it's very interesting that you call me today, because there has just an hour or two ago been a press conference at CERN raising the question as to whether or not the first hints of this Higgs boson have been seen. And it's a bit tantalizing that in order to know, well, the way that a particle experiment works, it's a bit analogous, say, to throwing dice. You know, if you've got some dice that you suspect might be loaded, you throw them a few times, and if, you know, six comes up a couple of times, well, it might be because the dice is loaded, or it might be just chance. But if you do it hundreds of times and it keeps happening, then you know you've definitely got loaded dice. And the analogy is a bit like that with these experiments, that you accumulate data and you start noticing that it looks as if there might be something going on, that there's a particle there, which, let's call it the Higgs boson, but you can't be sure. And as you accumulate more data, your certainty grows. And the tantalizing situation that has been reached is that there are two independent experiments at CERN, and the fact that there are two independent is itself quite important for science, each of which on its own is finding tantalizing hints that something might be going on, but not confident enough that they would say that they've discovered something. The thing, though, is that both experiments are seeing the same sort of tantalizing hints in the same sort of place. Mm-hmm. And Sherlock Holmes might have said, you know, when two strange things happen, Watson, they're usually connected. So there's a feeling that this may indeed be the first hints that there is something there. And really, one needs to now wait another 6 months to see, as the data accumulates, really if this is right. I think that 20 years from now, it's possible the textbooks could say that December the 13th, 2011 was the day that the Higgs boson first announced its presence, but that's for the future. As for today, we're savoring the excitement, and we can all share in the anticipation of what we will learn in the coming months, and the excitement is wondering what that will be.
And one of the other scientists that has been integral to this whole effort that you talk about in the book is an American scientist, an American physicist named James Borkin. Talk about him.
Yes, BJ, as he's known to everybody. He was working at Stanford in the 1960s, and he had the idea that enables scientists, other scientists, to do an experiment which looked inside the proton, the seed of the hydrogen atom, and found that protons are made of quarks. Now, the idea that quarks were there as a layer of reality had been around for a few years, but hardly anybody took it very seriously. But Bjorkane's idea enabled the experimentalists to go and look and see. Now, when the experimentalists did their work, the way that the data looked, if you like, was like abstract art. I mean, a splodge of different colours by analogy, and they couldn't make sense of it. And then BJ said to them, well, try reorganising the data in the way that my theory suggests. And when they did, it was like a picture suddenly emerging. And the three leaders of the experimental teams, Kendall, Taylor and Friedman, shared the Nobel Prize for that experimental discovery. And Henry Kendall, in his Nobel acceptance speech, compared the result of reorganizing the data the way that Bjorkane had suggested was like seeing the Balmer-Former formula appearing in front of you. For a scientist, that's one of the most beautiful things. BJ himself said to me more prosaically, Henry freaked out. So I think it was really BJ's insight that led the experimentalists to be able to interpret the data and reveal the quarks, from which we now have built the theories of how quarks behave. We are able to build, design, and analyze experiments as a result of those insights. So I would think that the last 50 years of particle physics have really been quark physics. And so, to me, it's Bjorkane's insights half a century ago that has, in practice, enabled particle physics to make many of the discoveries that it has subsequently done. The discoveries of the carrier of the weak force, the W boson, which won the Nobel Prize for Rubbia and van der Meer, was in part a consequence of Bjorkane's idea. The discovery of charged particles, which won a Nobel Prize for Ting and Richter, also was somewhat indirectly, but nonetheless a consequence of Bjorkane's idea. And the design of the experiments, the planning of the experiments at the LHC, and ultimately the interpretation of them, and the ability to extract the signature of a Higgs boson if it's lurking there among all the other noise that the experiments produce, will also be due to Bjorkane's insight. So without that, I don't think in practice we would have been doing things and others would not have been winning the Nobel Prizes that they have won.
And if we find that this Higgs boson does exist, if the LHC reveals it to exist, what's next? What is the next goal in terms of particle physics?
I love the sort of impatience, the discovery of the Higgs boson. Somebody on the British radio this morning was comparing this to physics like the discovery of DNA. I think that's a bit of an overstatement, but nonetheless, it is a goal that has been pursued, for many years. So let's just sort of pause a moment to say, well, where are we? I think that it is quite likely that today we are seeing the first hints that they have discovered a new fundamental particle at the LHC. Time will tell. Let's say 6 months from now, we will know for sure whether they have. However, being able to show that that fundamental particle is indeed the Higgs boson and not something else, that will take several years, because you've got to analyze the thing in very fine detail to see if it's got all the properties that a Higgs boson would have, rather than something completely different. So there's going to be quite a lot of work, first of all, being sure that this is the real deal. But let's suppose that it is. Then we will need to find out in full detail how nature plays the trick. Is it just a single boson that's doing it, or is this just one member of a family of a whole new things? And until we know the answer to that, we don't really know where the next set of questions flow. But the Higgs boson is just part of a huge picture. I think that if the Higgs boson is indeed showing up, then it shows that the LHC is indeed exploring the very regions where exciting discoveries are there to be made. If you like, we've found the continent and we have at last found the first indication that something interesting is there. What other interesting things might there be? And theoretically, there are a couple of other areas where people have great hopes. One is that we might find the enigmatic dark matter. Now, dark matter is something that the cosmologists have inferred by the way that the galaxies behave. There seems to be much more out there than we actually can see in any of our telescopes. So this stuff is known as dark because it doesn't shine in any wavelength. The problem is that there is no known particle that has the properties required to make dark matter. And the idea is that there are certain theories around called supersymmetry theories, which were invented for other reasons many years ago, but they do contain potentially particles with the properties that would be dark matter particles. If the LHC finds such things, that would be a remarkable symbiosis between cosmology and particle physics. And the fact that today's news suggests, if we're optimistic, that there might be a Higgs boson lurking at relatively light masses, that will give the supersymmetry people great excitement, because that would at least fit in with the ideas that their theories might be testable at the LHC. The other big thing is, why is there anything at all? Why did matter and antimatter not destroy themselves immediately after the Big Bang, leaving another sort of bang of closure, rather than a 13.6 billion year old universe of matter that is leading to you and me today? Something disturbed the balance, and the nature of that is still a mystery, but there are great hopes that the LHC might be exploring the right sort of questions that may give insights into that. So there's a whole range of questions. I think the LHC is a device that is, for the first time, exploring an epoch of the early universe that we've never been able to look at before. And today we're getting the first hint that there are interesting things there to find.
And is the LHC the state of the art, or is there going to be, at some point down the road, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, a desire for something that is beyond that?
Well, of course, there's always a desire. The question whether politically and economically those desires can ever be realized. But the nature of science is, I draw an analogy with, say, archaeology, where the first thing is you come and clear the site with sort of dump trucks and see if there are any interesting things there. And then, having exposed some interesting things, you want to look at them with great forensic detail using, you know, fine tools. The analogy in particle physics is that you clear the site by blasting protons, massive particles, at each other, and then you want to look at your discoveries with fine forensic tools, which in our trade are electrons. And that, roughly, that protons to electrons and back again, is the way that things have progressed over the last 50 years or so. The early physics was done with protons. The discovery of the quarks was done with electrons. Then the next stage, discovering the carriers of the weak force, was done with protons. Studying them in fine detail was done in the 1990s at CERN with electrons and their antimatter particles, positrons. It was those experiments that were so finely tuned that they began to give glimpses behind the scenes of things that looked like the Higgs boson and gave us the indications of what we would have to do to go find it, which then brings us to the latest blunderbuss, which is the proton machine, the LHC. And hopefully today we're finding the first glimpses of this new continent. Now, there'll be 20 years or more work surveying this continent with the LHC, so let's not sort of rush ahead of ourselves too far. But one can imagine that when one's got that first overview of what the continent has, the desire to be able to look in fine detail at things would require you to have a future electron machine. And people are already planning and thinking, what would this look like? How would you go about it in practice? The technology 20 years from now will, of course, be quite different than we have today. So what might appear to be out of the question now could well be quite practical in 20 years' time.
Are we, in fact, living in what some might consider a golden age of physics?
If today's news turns out to be the real deal, then I think we are living in a golden age of physics. I would think that the real golden age, though, was the theme in my book, The Infinity Puzzle, which was, you know, in the 1960s, when the seeds for today were sown. The first idea of unifying the forces, the discovery of this mathematical trick of how to get mass into the equations, Bjorkheim's insight into how to reveal the quark layer of reality, the proof that you can build a viable theory uniting these forces with which you can calculate, that was all in the 60s and early 70s. And from that has flown the era of discovery through to today, when hopefully we're now able to test and confirm these ideas. Whether today is a golden age in itself, of course, that we won't know until 20, 30 years down the line. You know where the golden ages are when you look back, though occasionally you know something special's happening, and it could turn out to be that today is one of those days.
Frank Close, the book is The Infinity Puzzle, Quantum Field Theory and the Hunt for the Orderly Universe. Frank, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.